Blog Talk Radio.
So those faithless and perverse generation. Can you say faithless and what else? What makes a man get perverted without faith? What's perverted our Christianity? Faithless.
Don't say that profess that God has given you power, love, and a sound mind, and your mind is not sound. You don't have power to overcome your present situation and circumstances.
Now the devil is always pushing. You can recognize the demons working because they always push to impetuous, immediate action. Don't think, do. And the devil says, if you don't do it now, you'll miss the opportunity. If you don't move now, if you don't sell now, if you don't jump now, it'll be gone.
And the kingdom of God is best expressed by authority and power to cast out devils.
Listen, dear friends. Don't forget that little word he said, seek ye first. Come on, that's the secret right there, seek ye first. Seek ye first. Oh, I tell you, the average person said, seek me first. That's it, seek me first. Put me first.
Well, anyone who opposes the kingdom of God and the casting out of devils. Because when we're of God's kingdom, our sole purpose is to destroy Satan's kingdom. Our sole purpose is to cast down Satan's kingdom.
I can tell you whether you won souls or not, whether you get your prayers answered, whether you're happy or not, whether you got a happy home or not, whether you're worth killing in the church or not. I can tell you, if you love your friends and let me see how you start your day out, if you grab a cup of coffee and a newspaper and sit down for an hour and let the Bible go begging, brother, you're mixed up in worldliness.
The Word of God said, we're going over to the other side. And in the midst of the Word of God said, we are going over to the other side, the enemy showed up in the storm. And the first thing that the enemy did was challenge those who walk with Christ. Those who eat with him and slept with him and saw the miracle, the signs and the wonders done by him. The first thing that the enemy did was steal the word that they heard right out of their hearts and then allow doubt to rise up on the inside of them. And instead of believing what the word of God said, they said, Lord, we perish.
Reading the word that's going to give you faith, that isn't what he's talking about. It isn't just hearing the word that's going to give you faith. You've got to open your spiritual ear or eye as you hear or read the word and appropriate by faith. Make it yours.
That'll sober you up. That ought to melt your silly heart. I'm not interested in your feelings and your little silly sentimentality. I'm wondering about your love for Christ and compassion for others. Do you care? I'm asking you one question tonight. Do you love Jesus or do you love this stinking world?
So God wants us to be doers of the word and not hearers only. Deceiving ourselves. How many folks are deceived every single week? Going to hear what they call the word and it never once emboldens them or give them a desire or a passion to do the works of Christ.
We want just a bunch of sickly sentimentality, and we want to just fix up sort of a hiding place and a loophole for sinners to say, well, if that old cuss made it in, I can make it in myself.
The kingdom is within you, and the only kingdom that this world is going to understand until the king comes is what they see in us. Because now we are the only creatures that have the ability to walk in darkness and to walk in light.
Oh, God's people, God!
Hey, shalom, 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 saints of the Most High. Hope everyone's doing well on this first day evening going into second day. Hope you all had a great first day and are excited to be serving the King. Truly do. This is Elder Becker with the Brother segment tonight. I appreciate you all giving the audio check. Good to know that it's coming in on a 10. Hope you're still chewing on the word from yesterday. Always good to hear new aspects of who we are as a people, especially when it comes to the covenant and understanding. And you know, one pastor said yesterday that, you know, there's probably a whole bunch of people coming into the truth yesterday. They're watching the side of that screen. You got to know that that message yesterday was just pure edification and just absolute truth. So I hope that y'all was able to quicken more to some of those that might have been the other side of that camera. I truly do. But, boy, it's 5 weeks go by fast. I mean, I'm telling you, I just looked up and, boo, we're here already. Just felt like I just did Blog Talk last week. But I do give all glory to the King for this honor of actually sitting here and speaking to the saints of the Most High. It's not a light thing at all, believe me. But I usually don't name my titles before my studies. Sometimes we can, and Teacher Shane will put them up there. So this one here, I mean, I went back and forth looking for a title on this, and, you know, I really couldn't come up with a good title, so I ended up calling it Monogamy and Situational Polygyny, and I think you're going to find out why that name is suitable. this particular study was of special interest to me because I started reading more of the aspects of our patriarchal fathers in Israel that were in polygynous lifestyles, and was really amazed about the stuff that a lot of times we just don't pick on and we just don't see. And it really was. I mean, it's because we hear about the fundamentals every time, and we hear about the fact that, yeah, our forefathers and a lot of our ancestors and mighty men of Yah, faithful men of Yah, were in polygynous households. But it's incredible to look at the way that these things came about. And in all of these instances I'm recovering tonight were all because of the incentive of the woman. It wasn't a man-driven thing. And that's why I got monogamy in the title as well, because as we're going to show, the mindset of a lot of our forefathers was purely a one-husband, one-woman household. And over the course of things, you know, of course their lives, things entered in, and that caused the woman in their house to make some request, and made some of the women realize the position they were in, and you know, other aspects that we're going to cover tonight. But I do believe you're going to find a lot of this very compelling, very interesting. I mean, I did, and that's why I felt the need to actually share this tonight. So I hope it's enjoyable. I hope that you get some edification and learning out of it. And with that, we're going to get started again. The title of this particular blog talk program tonight is called Monogamy and Situational Polygyny. Situational Polygyny, okay. And with that, we're going to get started. We're going to go talk about Abraham, our father of faith. And we're going to Genesis chapter 11. And we're going to start at verse 27, and we're going to go to verse 30, and we're going to be jumping back and forth in the book of Genesis, because, you know, that's where most of the, in fact, the, almost all of the life of Abraham is in detail, as much as we can learn. And again, I want to say thank you, Josh, up front for always, you know, being faithful and taking care of posting for the saints, for your labors there, and your, you know, time that you put in to, you know, help the brothers out on this segment. So thank you, sir. Appreciate that. Oh, and you know that we're only just a few weeks away from Tabernacles, so if you're coming and haven't got your name in, you better go, because the book is filling up real fast. So let's start Genesis chapter 11, verses 27 through 30. Let's get a little background to Abraham, Abram, and then to Abraham. Okay, verse 27, it says, now these are the generations of Terah. Terah beget Abram, Nahor, and Haran, and Haran began Lot. So we have this opening verse here, and we tell the genealogy that Terah being the father, and he was the father of Abraham, Nahor, and Haran, and Lot was the nephew of Abraham and Nahor, and the son of Haran. And Haran died before his father in Terah in the land of his nativity in Ur of the Chaldees. And Abram and Nahor took them wives. The name of Amram's wife was Sarai, and the name of Nahor's wife was Milcah, and the daughter of Haran, the father of Milcah, and the father of Iscah. So we have the situation, the father of these three brothers die, and then shortly after that, or sometime after that, doesn't really give a time frame. We have Abraham and Nahor, two of the brothers, taking wives. And obviously, Haran had already been married because he had Lot already as his first son. So all three of the sons of Terah are married at this point. Well, I mean, two are. The other brother's dead. So anyway, verse 30. But Sarai was barren and she had no child. So that statement's put in there to let us know the condition of Sarai. So we know that even though, you know, Abraham took her as a wife, you know, there was no idea that she was barren at the time because all women were hoping to bear seed for their husbands. You know, it was Sarah's desire to have a child that led to the building of many nations. Sarah or Abraham had no idea, this is the thing that really got me, that the building of the seed of Abraham and many nations that were to come out of his loins were the result of the barrenness of Sarah's womb. And I put that in there because her womb was the incentive to petition her husband to raise up child by her handmaid Hagar. We'll cover that too as well. And other thing to note, and it's going to come out a little bit more, is we're never given the age of Abram and Sarai when they were married. But we'll go through this discourse and we'll know that at least they were married for, you know, a certain amount of years before this was all instigated. Okay, this petition was put forth. This situation presented itself. Okay, going on to Genesis chapter 12, verses 1-5. Genesis 12, 1-5. I don't know. This Polycom has a huge amount of hiss in the background. I don't know if you can hear that or not. But oh well. Okay, Genesis 12, verses 1-5. Genesis 12, 1-5. Now Yahweh had said unto Abram, get thee out of thy country and from thy kindred and from thy father's house unto the land that I will show thee. And I will make of thee a great nation. And so here we got Genesis 2, that Yah is making these promises already to Abram. I will make of thee a great nation, and I will bless thee, and make thy name great, and thou shalt be a blessing. You know, Abram, he's getting these confirmations by the Most High. The Most High is revealing this to him, speaking to Abram, but Abram yet has a household where he doesn't have a son. So I'm wondering what's going on in his head. Does he really, like, is he thinking about this? Or, you know, what's the situation here? Because he has yet to have a seed to pass this down to. And I will bless them that bless thee, and curse them that curseth thee, and in thee shall all the families of the earth be blessed. So Abram departed, as Yahweh had spoken unto him, and Lot went with him. So they left Ur of the Chaldees and headed to where that the Most High had directed them to go. And Abram was 75 years old when he departed out of Haran. So we know that he was married sometime to Sarai, joined to her before age 75, or it could have been at age 75. But we never have that. Based on, you know, the speculation is because we see a lot of the patriarchs getting married in around age 40. That's possibly something that took place with Abram and Sarai. We have no idea. We don't know, but we know for a fact that when he left Ur of the Chaldees that he was 75 years old. And Abram took Sarai, his wife, and Lot, his brother's son, and all their substance that they had gathered and the souls that they had gotten in Haran, and they went forth to go into the land of Canaan. Into the land of Canaan they came. All right, Genesis 15, chapter 15, verses 1 and 2. Genesis 15, 1 and 2. So we got the story building here. We're getting the background on Abram. What his journey is, he's married now, he leaves his father's house, his land goes to the land of Canaan, he has his substance with him, Lot, his nephew is with him, and so they travel to the land of Canaan, and he's 75 years old. So again, in Genesis 15, Yahweh is going to speak to him again. And after these things, the word of Yahweh came unto Abram in a vision, saying, Fear not, Abram, I am thy shield and thy exceeding great reward. And Abram said, Yahweh the Elohim, what wilt thou give me, seeing I go childless? I mean, how am I supposed to inherit these promises, seeing that I go childless? How is this stuff going to come to pass? And the steward of my house is this Eleazar of Damascus. So Abram is questioning Yahweh as to what you could possibly give me that would be greater than an heir or son to actually be able to watch these blessings take place. And this is the, okay, let's keep going here. All right. Hang on a minute. All right, so this is such an interesting exchange between Yah and Abraham, and this is why. What is interesting is that Abraham is probably in his 80s when this conversation takes place. We don't know. Been married to the same only one wife, one woman, for how many X number of years? You know, it could be, as we'll find out, you know, up to close to 11 years. He has had no success producing an heir with Sarah, his wife, and yet through all this, he never enters into a polygynous life in order to raise up seed. And I found that astounding because there's no way to tell why Abraham, having heard these promises, didn't go out and try to step out and just make things happen on his own. It's almost as if he was in a position where he just was resolved and settled to remain in his monogamous relationship with his wife Sarah, in spite of the fact that he had no true heir born of his own seed. It's just sound thinking to know that a man is able to have more than one woman to raise up seed. So why didn't Abraham simply take for himself another wife? Again, there's no simple answer to this question. Perhaps Abraham had inquired of Yahweh many times and came to the conclusion because Sarah never became pregnant for whatever reason. Yahweh was saying to Abraham, just let it be. He didn't know. I mean, obviously he didn't know, but at this point in time, he received the promises. He obviously knows he has a wife that's barren, and yet having the knowledge of taking on another wife to produce his heir for the seed, he didn't enter into that relationship, and we don't know why. It's almost like that he was just content, or he's at least resolved to remain in a monogamous relationship and just see whatever Yah does it. Like Pastor said yesterday in Shabbat service, and a very good point, and this is clear here, is that Yah interfered in the lives of Abraham, and as we're going to find out in Jacob as well, because they're just waiting, you know, especially Abraham, he's just waiting for, well, how can this be when, man, I go, I don't have a child, you know, my substance is all going to go to the son of Eleazar, it's going to transfer completely to that heir, at least that's Abraham's thinking back then. He didn't think about taking another wife, was he that fully entrenched in monogamy that he was satisfied? There's no way to tell, but that is the fact of the matter. Okay, Genesis chapter 16, verses 1 through 4, and then Genesis 16:16. So again, this is why I'm calling this study Monogamy and Situational Polygyny, because it's giving us a really good view and understanding that as we're going to read more, that there was more of a monogamous type of mindset in the patriarchs, and Yah, through his intervention, made all the promises fulfilled that he had promised Abraham through Isaac and Jacob by the fact of, oh man, Josh, kick that piece of crap off there, will you? What a nasty little thing. But anyway, had made these promises happen, because Yah is a Yah of his word. Okay, so Genesis chapter 16, verses 1 through 4. Now Sarai, Abraham's wife, bare him no children, and she had a handmaid, an Egyptian, whose name was Hagar. And Sarai said unto Abram, Behold, now Yahweh hath restrained me from bearing. So Sarai is already convinced that it's the Most High that's keeping her from bearing, but she wants a child beyond all belief. I mean, she really wants, because that's the heart of a woman, right, to actually raise up seed for her son, or for her husband, excuse me, for his house. I pray thee, going unto my maid, it may be that I obtain children by her. And Abraham hearkened to the voice of Sarai. So, again, we have the situational polygyny, where there's a situation coming in here by where this woman, through Sarah, was added to Abraham's house because she had a desire to actually obtain children. The word obtain is very interesting. It means to be built up, of a childless wife becoming a mother of family through the child, children of a concubine. That's what the word means. So it may be that I may be built up so I can be a mother of a family through the children of a concubine. That's the word obtain means here. Okay, so here again we have the situation arriving where we have Abraham that was content, or he was resolved. He was just going to go with the flow, didn't seek out another woman to make this promise happen. He just sat back and was like, okay, whatever's going to happen, right? I mean, Yahweh said it, but he ain't making no inroads to do anything. And now here we know, because of the barren womb of Sarah, she's instigating this. This is the incentive to get this whole thing rolling. So again, and Sarai said unto Abram, behold, now Yahweh hath restrained me from bearing. I pray thee, go in unto my maid. It may be that I obtain children by her. And Abram hearkened unto the voice of Sarah. So this was, for whatever reason, the first push that he had, and he listened to Sarai. And I don't know, he thought it just made sense or whatever the fact is, but he understood the promise. I'm sure he had told her, and he's like, okay, well, maybe this is the way. I don't know. Verse 3, and Sarai, Abraham's wife, took Hagar, her maid, the Egyptian, and Abram had dwelt 10 years in the land of Canaan, and gave her to her husband Abram to be his wife. And he went into Hagar, and she conceived, and when she saw that she had conceived, her mistress was despised in her eyes. You know, clearly it was not by Abraham's leading and desire that he entered into a polygynous house, but it came by the way of a request from Sarah, his wife, that he might obtain children through Hagar. Sarah's incentive for petitioning her husband was so that she might have a child to call her own by the womb of Hagar. It's clear that Abraham was settled on not having a child after his own loins, and he had appeared to come to terms with this fact. What we can also ascertain out of these events is that Sarai didn't petition her husband to take another wife, but to offer her a slave woman, which I thought interesting. A different wife having a child would have remained the fruit of that wife, or that fruit of that woman, but because it was a concubine, that child became the property of Hagar's mistress, or her owner, or the woman that had rule over her, which was Hagar, which was Sarai. So if it would have been Abraham taking another wife, then Sarah still wouldn't have had the right to that child, because that child would have belonged to the other wife. But being this was a slave, that's how she gained ownership. Genesis 16:16. And Abram was fourscore and 6 years old when Hagar bare Ishmael to Abraham. So again, we hear the story of the father of faith. He's at least 11 years married to, Sarai, or Sarah. And he makes no changes in his family structure to help the promise come be fulfilled. He decides, in whatever case, he looks resolved to just remain in his monogamous relationship and find out and wait and do whatever. I mean, Yah promise. He's true to his word. You know, it says Abraham kept his law, statutes, and commands. So we know that Abraham was a faithful man in many ways. But he let this all play out. And again, who would ever figured that it was the woman in the relationship that got this whole thing rolling because of a barren womb? See, Yah does all things well and all things marvelously. And I can't even tell you how many years that Sarai was in grief, because we know of other instances of women who were barren that were in great grief and lament, like Hannah, for instance, you know, who vowed her son, if she had one, before Eli, that you know, he would be a servant of the Most High all his days. So again, we have incentive here. We have the drive of the woman, and Yah using the woman here to help fulfill the promise he was given to the man. Okay, Isaac, the son of promise. one. Again, we're just going right down the road, the patriarchs here. Isaac, the son of promise. All right, Genesis chapter 25, verses 19 and 20, and then Genesis 35, 28 and 29. Then we're going to jump somewhere else. Still, we're just doing little short clips out of here. Verse 19, and these are the generations of Isaac, Abraham's son. Abraham begat Isaac, and Isaac was 40 years old when he took Rebekah to wife, the daughter of Bethuel, the Syrian of Padan-Aram, the sister of Laban the Syrian. So we have the whole backdrop, the whole story, that Isaac, who of course being the son of Abraham, and the son by the birthright of Sarah, and this is the son that the promise was spoken about. And he's 40 years old. So now, and there's a, you know, points very, because there's so many people that we show that and gotten into, you know, come together and been married in the Word, but and you have to take note of the ones that the age is actually put in there. There's, I believe there's a specific reason because it helps tell the timetable. So we have Isaac being 40 years old. He took Rebekah for his wife. And lays out her past and her connections and her relationships. Genesis 35, 28 and 29. And the days of Isaac were 180 years. That's 180 years old. And Isaac gave up the ghost and died and was gathered unto his people being old and full of days. And his sons Esau and Jacob buried him. It is clear that when Isaac took Rebekah for wife that he was 40 years old. And it is clear that when Isaac died he was 180. Of course, there's no way to tell if Isaac would have been able to get children through 140 years from Rebekah to his death, meaning the 140 years that he was alive after he took her for a wife, because we don't know when she died. But what we do know that men are able to father children well into their 90s and in their early 100s, as was demonstrated by Abraham, the father of faith. And we can also know that Rebekah was alive at least up until the point that Esau took to himself at wives at age 40. So both of them would have been in their 80s when this happened. So they were together at least 40 years. So this would conclude that Isaac and Rebekah had at least this many years to have more children. And Genesis 26, 34 tells us that Esau was 40 years old when he took to wife Judith, the daughter of Beeri the Hittite, and Bashemeth, the daughter of Elon the Hittite. And you don't know if they were at the same time, but obviously Esau went right into a polygynous relationship. Verse 35, which were a great grief of mine unto Isaac and to Rebekah. You know, and it appears by you looking at Isaac's life over 140 years after he was, from the time he was married to Rebekah up until the time of his death, that he was satisfied only having two seed. That was it. He had the seed, and one of them was going to go to the promise, to inherit the promise that Abraham, and was also spoken to Isaac. And he was content, and that's just a marvel that over that many years, you know, he stayed solid in a monogamous relationship. You can tell he wasn't moved one way or the other to take another wife and on board. He had his two sons, and he was satisfied. And he lived out his life until his old age, and then he passed. And, you know, again, we see the same set in Abraham, and then we see the same thing happening with Isaac. And because, you know, there was a one-man, one-woman type of relationship going on back then. what we need to understand is that Yahweh is in control of the numbers of his people, and we see evidence of this fact many times throughout the Word. Because the reason I'm talking about is because we can see through Abraham and through Isaac's thus far is that there hasn't been a huge population explosion of you know, pre-Israelites coming from the loins of Abraham. I know Abraham through Keturah had a decent amount of sons. That is true, but these were the children not given to the promise. So, up until this point, you know, their numbers remain pretty small. And we see evidence of this fact many times throughout the Word. In times of war, we can read of accounts where Yahweh defeated the enemies of Israel through a small fighting force of men. For example, Israel did not come out of Egypt in the Exodus with a fighting force of over 600,000. Egypt in the Exodus did come out with a fighting force of over 600,000 men, but the Promised Land was conquered through a number of fighting men less than 40,000, as the previous 600,000 all died and perished in the wilderness. in the account in Judges, when Gideon went up against the Midianites, the force of Israel were numbered at 22,000 fighting men, but Yahweh made it so that the Midianites were destroyed by the hands of only 300 men, 300 Israelites. It is quite evident that Yahweh does these things to prove to all men that it is always by his hand that we are either delivered or defeated. And with each victory, all the glory belongs solely to him, for we can do nothing without him. And by every defeat, we can know that there is sin in the camp. Now, remember, Yahweh favored Israel because they were the least of all people, the smallest in the number of all the nations. Yahweh demonstrated this in war repeatedly against the enemies of Israel and their defeats to show all the nations that Yahweh was the El of Israel, and he was the one which preserved his people, and that Israel did not sustain themselves or become mighty through sheer numbers. Because you remember what happened when David tried to number the men. He was using the force and the strength of the number of men to show Israel's strength, but Yah has always been Israel's strength. Ephesians chapter 1, verses 4 and 5, we read by the words of Paul how Yahweh had chosen us in him before the foundation of the world, having predestinated us under the adoption of children by Yahshua, the Messiah, according to the good pleasure of his will. We read of it in Acts chapter 2, how it was Yahweh that added 3,000 souls to his nation in one day, and how it was Yahweh that adds to the assembly daily such as should be saved. The body of Messiah is being built through the bearing of children. Yes, absolutely, and keep having your children. But Yahweh is also keeping his numbers and adding to his assembly also, in greater numbers through the preaching of the message. In this day and age, we see clearly demonstrated by Pastor Dow how Yahweh raised him up to be a voice to his people in these last days, to speak the word of truth through his mouth, that those who have been predestined should hear the truth and come to their Maker and King, Jesus the Messiah. Now, if Yahweh was building the nation of Israel strictly through the seed of men, then what would the need for preaching be? So we can see that there's a twofold thing going on here, if you understand where I'm coming from. So we're going to move on to Jacob, who is Israel. Again, we're talking about situational polygyny and how the fathers in our faith came about to entering into a polygynous household. And we can see so far, at least through Abraham, that he was, I don't want to use reluctant, but he was slow about taking on another woman, and things worked out that it came in through Sarai, his wife, and that's how these promises came to be, and that's how his son came to be. And now we're going to find out the same with Jacob. We find that Isaac just decided to follow in the steps and he was contented and Pastor said it before. I mean, not everybody, you don't have to get into polygyny. I mean, if you're content as a husband in a monogamous relationship, by all means, we can see that our forefathers certainly were, and then things change in their life, and because Yah interfered, basically, if we can use that word in a pure sense, made things happen in their life so he could fulfill his will, if that makes sense. All right, glory King. Genesis chapter 29, back in Genesis 29:10 through... let's see, 10 through, shoot, it's a big one. 10 through 30. Genesis chapter 29, verses 10 through 30. Excuse me. And it came to pass when Jacob saw Rachel, the daughter of Laban, his mother's brother, and the sheep of Laban, his mother's brother, that Jacob went near and rolled the stone from the well's mouth and watered the flock of Laban, his mother's brother. So we're going to break down and we're going to look at the backstory of how Jacob ended up being joined to Rachel. And Jacob kissed Rachel and lifted up his voice and wept. And Jacob told Rachel that he was her father's brother and that he was Rebekah's son, and she ran and told her father. So they have their meeting. And the first ones to meet these two. And it came to pass when Laban heard the tidings of Jacob, his sister's son, that he ran to meet him and embraced him and kissed him and brought him to his house. And he told Laban all these things. And Laban said unto him, surely thou art my bone and my flesh. And he abode with him the space of a month. And Laban said unto Jacob, because thou art my brother, should thou therefore serve me for naught? I mean, for nothing. You're just going to be here for a month. You've been working. What is that I can give you in exchange? He said, tell me, what shall thy wages be? And of course, now Jacob hadn't revealed it up until this time, at least through the first month. But now that the question's been out there and something's been presented, and then he has the floor to speak, so to speak. And Laban had two daughters. The name of the elder was Leah, and the name of the younger was Rachel. Leah was tender-eyed, but Rachel was beautiful and well-favored. And Jacob loved Rachel and said, I will serve thee 7 years for Rachel, thy younger daughter. And Laban said, it is better that I give her to thee than I should give her to another man. Abide with me. Okay, so I'll make that agreement. You're going to stay here for 7 years. And basically what Jacob did is he worked the 7 years as his bride price to earn the father's the right to take this woman to be his wife. Okay. And so verse 20, it says that, and Jacob served 7 years for Rachel, and they seen on him but a few days for the love he had for her. Now, this is just something I put here for note, and I don't know if it really it has something that we can think on, but I was just thinking is that, because Jacob had committed to remain faithful in serving for Rachel for those 7 years, that the whole time, there's nothing says that was stopping him from taking another wife at that time, another woman to wife. I don't know what law would have prohibited that, because he's already in one relation. Maybe it's because that we find out later in Deuteronomy, is it 24, where a man takes a wife, he's supposed to cheer up for a year. That's possible, because the laws were there before they were actually written, at least what we understand. I think is Genesis, what chapter it is, where it talks about Abraham, that he kept the laws and the commandments and the statutes of Yahweh. So it's possible, but it's something you might notice, but neither here nor there. So Jacob served the 7 years. He got to the end of 7 years, and, but to him, because he loved this woman so much, he didn't do like a lot of the brethren do that we've dealt in over the years here, is that, they go out searching and they see these women from these other nations, and they get a wink, wink, nod, nod type thing going on, and they get something flaring up, inside of them, and they say, hey, this is a good woman here. She talked to me. She may have asked his brother a question or posted him on Facebook or at work or whatever the situation is, and they think that's a green light to automatically, hey, I'm going to take this woman, not even considering the fact if Yah's only using the man, using that brother at that time to actually draw this sister, like elders, let him be a sister first, right? I mean, we've had to deal with this so many times, and it's disturbing as much as we talked about it. But if you really have a care for a woman and hope someday to take her as a wife, it may not happen. Show them what kind of honor as a brother that you need to, and tell her, hey, look, you should be talking to one of the sisters in the ministry. That's what you need to do, because you want to test to make sure that this woman who has started asking questions about the reason of faith, that hope that lies in you, because they can obviously see a different lifestyle and different manner that, these brothers conduct themselves, do them the honor of just saying, look, hey, I'm going to have you talk to a sister, and she can better relate to you, or woman to woman, she can answer your questions just as well. And, I hope that Yah deals you. Let them build up a relationship with the Most High, because it's Yahweh. You seek ye first the kingdom of Yah and all his righteousness, and these things shall be added unto you. So if that's your mindset, go on, and you can look and say, hey, I'm watching this sister that looks like somebody from another nation that Yah's dealing with, and let it play out and let Yah deal with it. See what this sister's love truly is. If she's got shine for the brother, then she isn't trying to build a relationship with the Most High. She just wants the brother for wife, and hopefully that, she'll make the sacrifice, whatever, just to stay with some man. But a lot of times it doesn't work out too well, because her heart really wasn't in the way, if you know what I mean. And I don't want to get too far off that. So getting back on this account with Jacob, again, we're talking about situations that in Israel that brought up a polygynous household. we can see that it really wasn't instigated by the man at all. It wasn't pushed by the man. It wasn't promoted by the man. It was on the part of the woman. And Jacob said unto Laban, give me my wife, for my days are fulfilled, that I may go in unto her. And Laban gathered all the men of the place and made a feast. And it came to pass in the evening that he took Leah his daughter and brought her to him, and he went in unto her. Now here's another great example. When you're looking at this, and it's right here, written in here, and it's never really talked about, but it's another perfect example that polygyny, having multiple wives, is totally, absolutely accepted. We have Yah driving this stuff, right? So we have Laban, and he's pulling this fast maneuver, man, because Laban, I'm sorry, but you read about this man, he's a shyster. I mean, he's out to make gain on every which way he can, and he tries to stay within the lines, but he's also way over in that gray area, if you know what I mean. But he's given his first daughter to Jacob instead of Leah. And if polygyny was not lawful or it was not the will of the Most High, again, why would Laban just freely do this thing? If there was some prohibition against it or some hesitation against it, that Yah would be angry. No, it was freely. It was just part of the natural ways of the relationships between men and women. If a man wanted to have one and stay monogamous, that was his choice, that we see by Isaac clearly. And it appears that Abraham was going that way. And then we got the situation Jacob. His focus was on only one woman, even though Laban had two daughters. And, you know, by Laban's hand, Jacob enters into a polygynous relationship that I don't believe he was looking to enter into. It just so happened that way. And again, we see the will of Yah playing out. Verse 24, so again, we have a situation here that occurred, that the incentive part was on Laban, but he was able to, you know, unload both of his daughters at the same time. Now we're going to see some more situations here that help Jacob's family to grow, not only to two wives, but also the two concubines that were included. Chapter 29, verse 24. And Laban gave unto his daughter Leah Zilpah, his handmaid, for a handmaid. And it came to pass that in the morning, behold, it was Leah, and he said to Laban, what is this thou hast done? Did I not serve thee for Rachel? Wherefore then hast thou beguiled me? It had to be really dark in them chambers. Obviously, there was no light in there at all, because I don't know if she didn't speak, because you'd think they got to have different voices or something, but for Jacob not to realize it, I don't know if because of the feast, he had a little bit too much wine in him and didn't pay that close of attention, but that always got me how that he was able to go lay with this woman thinking it's Rachel or making her wife, and turns out to be the older daughter. Maybe it was too much drink. Who knows? I don't know. There's no way to know that, but the fact of the matter is, we have the situation unfolding where Jacob just walks right into a polygynous household. What is this thou hast done unto me? Did I not serve thee for Rachel? Wherefore then hast thou beguiled me? And Laban said, it must not be done in our country, to give the younger before the firstborn. Fulfill our week, and we will give thee this also for the service which thou hast served with me yet 7 other years. So, I mean, again, here's the shyster again. Okay, Jacob's already filled the 7 years expecting Rachel, and then you got Laban. Okay, I'll tell you what, all right, yeah, you can still have her, but I need this much more from you. I mean, I already satisfy you with my oldest daughter, which is our custom, so, you know, this is my further demand. And it's like, man, I don't know, he put up with him that long, but at least 14 years. And Jacob did so and fulfilled the week, and he gave him Rachel, his daughter, to wife also. So right from the onset, we can see that Jacob was satisfied with just Rachel. He wasn't at all concerned or thinking about, and of course, as a newlywed, who would be? And if he did follow the tenets of the word, that we realize he's going to cheer her up for a year. We don't know if that was, you know, something that was put out there, or actually a custom that the people did back then, but we do know that his eyes were pretty much just centered on Rachel, right? And now he finds himself in a polygynous relationship. He got two wives. Okay, verse 29. And Laban gave to Rachel his daughter Bilhah, his handmaid, to be her maid. So both the daughters got the gifts from their fathers, their personal maids, the personal concubine, or handmaids, slave girls, right? And he went in also unto Rachel, and he loved also Rachel more than Leah, and served yet with him yet 7 other years. And when Rachel saw that she bare Jacob no children, Rachel envied her sister and said unto Jacob, give me children or else I die. So now we got Rachel, and again, she has a desire that she really wants to produce a seed for her husband and show her husband that she can be fruitful. And but Jacob still loves her nonetheless, right? Still totally loves her. Loves her greater than Leah. And we see that same account with Elkanah, you know, with Hannah and Penaniah. And these husbands weren't so concerned about having seed. They were just thrilled to have the woman that they truly loved. And Jacob's anger was kindled against Rachel and said, am I Yah in Yah's stead? Who hath withheld the fruit of the womb? Knowing that Yah could break forth the womb and open up and Rachel might conceive. Again, as we can see, we have a situation very much like that of Abraham and Sarah. As in the case of Rachel, she was not able to conceive and bear children for her husband. And we see again that the solution Rachel was to provide for her husband was her slave in her stead to raise up seed. This, of course, being the thing to actually help Rachel, just like Sarah, to have a child she can call her own. And it's again by the womb of a slave girl who doesn't get to retain the ownership that goes to the one that has the rule over, and that would be Rachel. So we have the same pattern here, but again, we have situational a polygyny getting added to Jacob's house because of, again, in this case, envy and a barren womb. And so Rachel is promoting this idea that you take my handmaid so I can have children and show that, you know, I'm fruitful in this house and that I'm not a reproach, even though Jacob loved her. And she said, behold, my maid Bilhah, go in unto her, and she shall bear upon my knees, so I may also have children by her. Surrogate women, basically what that was. And she gave Bilhah her handmaid to wife, and Jacob went unto her, and Bilhah conceived and bare Jacob a son. And Rachel said, Yah hath judged me and hath also heard my voice and hath given me my son. Therefore she called his name Dan. And Bilhah, Rachel's maid, conceived again and bare Jacob a second son. So she's in joy because now she's actually having children that she gets to raise and nurture as her own. And Rachel said, with great wrestlings have I wrestled with my sister, and I have prevailed. Again, wrestled with her sister. She's at war with her sister, at odds with her sister, to see who can produce an heir, produce to make their husband happy by making his family bigger and more wealthy. And believe me, that Jacob, you know, he was doing pretty well there. And I have prevailed, and she called his name Naphtali. And when Leah saw that she had left barren, she took Zilpha, her maid, and gave her Jacob to his wife. And you have to figure that Jacob had no intention beyond these two, and they introduced this custom, so by Yah's incentive, by his interference, I should say, that also we have Jacob coming into a situation where he was just interested in one woman, and then by the end of the thing, and how everything worked out, now he's actually able to fulfill the promise of Yah by being added to his house, two women, two wives, and two concubines. And this is how Yah does everything amazingly, and things that outside what we can even imagine how he orchestrates things. Anyway, when Leah saw that she left barren, we read that she took Zilpha, her maid, gave her Jacob to wife. And Zilpha, Leah's maid, bare Jacob a son. And Leah said, a troop cometh, and she called his name Gad. And Zilpha, Leah's maid, bare Jacob a second son. And Leah said, happy am I, for the daughters will call me blessed. And she called his name Asher. Okay. Okay, and we're going to end here. We're going to read Isaiah 3 and part of Isaiah 4, and everybody knows that talk is talked about a whole lot in here, but there's a lot of significance to Isaiah 3 and Isaiah 4 because you see another instance of possible situational polygyny because of what was placed on the women there And again, this wasn't the man's incentive, or this wasn't the man's searching or seeking. This came about because the women were playing their part, trying to be under covering or, you know, produce a child or whatever for the husband to show that, you know, they were of value to the family. All right, let me see. Yep. Isaiah chapter 3, we're going to read the whole thing. So it's verses 1, Isaiah 3, 1 through... And blah, 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 blah. 26 verses. And what you have to remember, like, okay, the book of Isaiah is kind of broken down into sections. And a lot of the trouble, and hopefully the Israelites know this when they read, that you have to remember one time there wasn't chapter and verse. So we actually can rob ourselves of understanding better contextually about what we're reading when we think that, well, because the chapter starts there, there's a new line of thoughts starting there, and it doesn't have anything to do with the chapter preceding it, which is total bunk. I mean, you'll find it all flows together, like the first five chapters of the book of Isaiah, when he's going to, by the mouth of Isaiah, by the mouth of Isaiah, proclaim what's going to happen to this people, Israel, and Judah more specifically, because of their poor relationship with the Most High. But just to read one and not let it flow together all as one thing is actually doing the word a disservice. It really is. And when you read it together, it makes the whole story just come together and really talk and really tells its own story, its own self. We just basically read it. Okay, verse 1, Isaiah chapter 3, verse 1. For behold, Yahweh, the Master of hosts, does take away, which means to be removed from Jerusalem and Judah, the stay and staff, the whole stay of bread, and the whole stay of water. So what's happening here in the first verse is Yahweh is going to create a situation, and it's by his hand because of disobedience. Again, reading the other chapters leading up to chapter 3, the other chapter 1 and 2, and you're going to find out the state of Israel and Judah while Yah is going to do this. I mean, because they were in disobedience, and we're going to see that in a greater measure about where the women's hearts were in this whole situation. So he's going to start by removing the abundance of the earth that he promised he would bless Israel with, or his people, if they obeyed him. But obviously, because they didn't, he's going to withhold the fruit of the earth and take away and remove from Jerusalem and the borders of Judah the food supply and the water. You know, this is coming down to punishment here. And he's also going to remove away, in verse 2, not only the food supply, but he's also going to go farther. He's going to start working on the men. He's going to remove the mighty man, verse 2, and the man of war, the judge and the prophet and the prudent and the ancient. Of course, the judge and the prophet, they shall be taken away, and the result of this will be none to keep the ways of the people in righteousness, because that's what their role was there. They're taken away, and the people will be absolutely lost. They may have been trying and not succeeding, but the fact they may have been corrupt, but the fact is the ones that are taken away were probably the ones that... Well, I can't even say that. I'm not sure why they were taken away, but we know the men in general. Isaiah chapter verse 3. And what will also be taken away? So we have in verse 2, the mighty man, the man of war, the judge, the prophet, the prudent, the ancient. We're going to find out Yah is going to list them all, the captain of 50, the honorable man, and the counselor, and the cunning artificer, and the elegant orator. So we read a list of people, all men, who are to be taken away or removed from Jacob will be by war, famine, slave labor, or death. And as we read further on, that's why I was able to put that in there. When Nebuchadnezzar, at this time, he had not, Assyria had already taken Israel captive, but Judah had not yet been taken captive. This is to come a little bit in the near future. But Yah is already telling them what's going to happen to them because of their disobedience. And it's a near point in the future when Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, invades and captures Judah and Jerusalem and, puts Yah's people into captivity. Now, this list of these men, that we just read includes those men who are protectors, they're warriors for Judah, those men who are the judges to keep the order of Judah, those men who are the prophets and the voice of Yahweh to speak to the people, those the prudent and old men with wisdom because of their years on them, their ages, who give advice and knowledge. We have men of rank and title to whom the people can trust to lead and care for them. They're going to be taken away, are going to be removed. We have the counselors who have been trusted to give direction, advice, and bring knowledge and awareness to men's minds. They're going to be taken away and removed. We got those skilled men, men wise in their crafts and their building trades, that were there to help Jacob and continue to build the city under the prosperity at one time. Those men that are going to be taken away also are the prayer warriors. And with all these males absent in Judah, who's going to oversee and keep the children and the women? Because there's nobody, there's no male figures really left there. Are there some left there? Yeah. After this prophecy starts to fulfill, yes, there's going to be a few men left there, but for the bulk of them, they're going to be gone. So we're setting up the what's going to happen when we read in Isaiah 4:1. This is all the prelude to, that's why it's so important to just remove chapter and verse and read it as one whole writing, if you understand what I'm saying. Okay, now, these men were the trusted, competent leaders in Judah who were fathers of families, the husbands to wives, they were the brothers and the sons. It's these men that were taken away, it's not these weak, effeminized men that we see today that don't know their place, that allow the wives and the children to rule and ruin them. I mean, these men of no count because they don't add any strength to a household or a body. These are those men who don't have backbone and lead their houses, those men who compromise righteousness so that they can have peace in their home, men who are fearful to stand up and assume their roles. That's not these men. We're talking mighty men and competent men and men that were there to actually edify and strengthen the body of Judah there. But they're all going to be removed and taken away. And it's going to be left a few effeminate, weak men in the midst and those that have no strength and no authority and the women, and women and children. Verse 4, and I will give children to be their princes, and babes shall rule over them. And I think that the indication is here is those that are coming along that are going to be ruling over what's left of Judah in Jerusalem are going to be, you know, basically men that have the understanding and they're not really ever been qualified to leave, but they're basically going to be put in there to rule, you know, with the mindset of a children, is almost as another insult added to the house of Judah because of their disobedience. Verse 5, and the people shall be oppressed. Well, absolutely, who wouldn't be? I mean, there's no food. You're in captivity. The men are gone. You know, you got children. You got to feed the children. You got to take care of the children, what are left. And, you know, it's just complete chaos. Okay, the people shall be oppressed. The word oppressed means to exploit, take advantage, or mistreat. So the people shall be mistreated. They're going to be taken advantage of. They're going to be exploited. Everyone by another and everyone by his neighbor. I mean, survival, right? Survival of the fittest. The hell with brotherly love and sisterly love, man. This is every man for himself. The child shall behave himself proudly against the ancient, the base against the honorable. And again, this is all the result of having no structured male authority in the area. And nobody to influence the lives to take care to oversee things, they're all going to be removed. Verse 6, when a man shall take hold of his brother of the house of his father, saying, thou hast clothing, be our ruler, let this ruin be under thy hand. I mean, who is going to take that charge? I mean, who would do that? Go ahead, let this ruin, you take care of this mess. You know? And in that... And in that day shall he swear, saying, I will not be a healer, or that means a ruler, one to take charge and make whole again the state of the people. I will not be a healer, the one to repair this mess. For in my house is neither bread nor clothing. Make me not a ruler, people. I got no influence. I got no wealth. I'm a poor man. And that's probably why I was left here. Yeah, I'm a no count. So don't come up and start promoting me and say that I'm going to be the new ruler because I'll be the next one thrust through with the sword, right? These folk were laying low profiles because they valued their life. I mean, remember, every man was taking advantage of each other. And so it was, again, the survival of the fittest, I guess you can use that word. Okay, in verse 8, for Jerusalem is ruined and Judah is fallen because their tongue and their doings are against Yahweh to provoke the eyes of glory. So Isaiah is giving the reason here in verse 8 why Judah is fallen and Jerusalem come into heaps, or will come into heaps when Nebuchadnezzar gets there, because of their tongues and their doings that are continually against the Most High to provoke his eyes of his glory. Verse 9, the show of their countenance does witness against them. They declare their sin as Sodom. They hide it not. Just blatantly out there, right? Just open and walking in wickedness and lawlessness just like it is today. There's no hiding it. It's, you're like promoting it and comfortable with it. And it goes on to say, they hide it not. Woe unto their soul, for they rewarded evil unto themselves. I mean, you brought this judgment upon yourself just simply by your behavior. Verse 10, say ye to the righteous that it well shall be well with him, for they shall eat the fruit of their doings. Verse 11, but woe unto the wicked, it shall be ill with him, for the reward of his hand shall be given him. Verse 12, and Yah makes this clear. He says, as for my people, this is my people. Now I'm making this specific who I'm talking about. Children are their oppressors. Again, we understand what the word oppressors mean, right? Those that get their get advantage taken care of, get mistreated, exploited. So children are those that are going to be their oppressors, and women rule over them, meaning the people, Yah's people. O my people, they which lead thee cause thee to err and destroy the way of thy paths. So what we have is a result of all that we know up through verse 12 is that this has turned basically into matriarchal society like we have today in this world. Women have taken up the role of being the ones to make the decisions, to call the shots, you know, because the men aren't there and the men aren't being the men that are there. So they have to take control, and that changes their spiritual structure when they have to get into them roles and the roles that they weren't meant to be in. They're meant to be the help me, not the ones asking everybody else for help to get the job accomplished and being the one to call the shots. And again, to take control and charge over the people as those men who this falls on become to weakness and fears. And also this is by men who have left off from ensuring the ways of righteousness and keeping the old path straight and pure. And the children, obviously, they become little tyrants over their mothers, to their mothers. Obviously, you can see in this time, you know, the food is low. The male status is pretty much gone, and these little tyrants become demanding and spoiled and undisciplined. And parents and women, I mean, men, these children tend to get left off to themselves because these women that birthed them don't want to deal with them no more, and the dad ain't around to deal with them no more, so they just basically let them run. And, of course, this is what's going to happen in an oppressive society when the children have free reign. And they're going to be dishonorable to all, regardless of age or status, and basically completely unmanageable. Okay, verse 13. And Yahweh standeth up to plead, means rebuke, contend against, and stand to judge the people. So he's going to show them, man, I'm not satisfied. The ways you're doing, you're doing sin, you don't even hide no more. I'm going to stand up, I'm going to set this thing back in order again. Because nobody else is, so I'm going to take care of this. When Yah does it, you know it's him. And Yah will enter into judgment with the ancients of his people and the princes thereof, and you have eaten up the vineyard, the spoil of the poor is in your houses. Meaning, because they have testified against the wickedness of the people in their day, talking about the ancients and the princes, that Yah is going to, as they judge back then, basically, their voices are carrying over into this time, because if they were living in this time, they would be speaking the same thing and standing fully with Yah in what his judgments are going to be against the people. They wouldn't have never let it happen, the rulers of the past. But now that we're in this situation, and that's the witness of the way things that were handled before by the righteous men, they would stand up in the same, say the same thing that Yah is about to deal with his people. Verse 15, What meaning that beat my people to pieces and grind the faces of the poor, saith Yahweh of hosts. Moreover, Yahweh saith, because the daughter... Now he's going to start focusing on the women. He's already covered the men. He's talked about the children being oppressors. And he's indicated women have given the place of rule because there's no men there anymore. He's not real men anyway. Most of them are feminized or weak or worthless or, and just like bums, like a lot of what we have today. And they're of no count. And that's what happens to a society when they go matriarchal. And this, we're going to read about this in the remaining verses about what women do when they're left under their own control and their own devices, when they decide not to seek a cover, seek to be under authority, seek to be given the direction, seek to find security that remains in male authority. Moreover, Yahweh saith, because the daughters of Zion are haughty, so he's describing their state, even in the midst of all this, they're full of pride and they're high-minded and lofty. And all this oppression, the food's going to be short, and they still have to walk with this high-minded attitude as though there's something. And that, you know, you'd think, well, how in the world could they actually do it? Well, because, you know, they're the ones calling the shots, and there's sort of a pride there now. And walk with stretched forth necks and wanton eyes, walking and mincing as they go, making tinkling with their feet. Again, I believe a reasonable conclusion to what we're about to read concerning the behavior of the Israelite women is because there were no longer sound, competent men leading them. Many were taken away, and the men had been taken away, and what was left in the midst of these daughters of Zion was incompetent, effeminate men who didn't possess the manhood to resist the oppressive children and domineering women. And again, this is very much like today's generation of men, where they do not know how to lead their homes to be fathers and husbands and brothers and sons. Men that are soft and compromised, weak and ineffective in their roles as males. And I can tell you, weekly I deal with men calling in here that are having marriage problems, and they're always looking at these women, and it's obviously when you listen to them talk a while, you know, they just don't have a set of gonads to get out there and do it. They're afraid of losing their wives. They're trying their best to, you know, and they use certain, you know, I'm just, you know, slowly leading them, and then, but... they're getting more trounced on, and because, of course, you're dealing with a woman. That's all that, you know, raised in this Western mindset and Yah isn't dealing with. At some point, the only way you may be able to win her is you stand up and grow a pair and show that you're going to perform your role as Yah had said for you to do, and you may actually may gain her when she sees a real man for once. Who knows? Hard to tell. Verse 17, therefore Yahweh will smite with the scab the crown of the head of the daughters of Zion. This is key, and Yahweh will discover their secret parts. And by doing this, again, discover their secret parts is essentially to bring them to an open shame, much the same way a person would get stripped naked and made to stand before strangers and all the people to expose the lewdness and the disorder of the daughters of Zion who have brazenly taken to wickedness and have left their place, which is that of the woman, and have taken the position such as a man should only have. This is a very important dynamic we need to realize, as we will see in Isaiah 4:1. This was the shame that those seven women declared was upon them. We already have it right here. Yah is going to discover this. He's going to expose what these women are doing, and he's going to do it by the spirit of burning and the spirit of judgment, as we read late in Isaiah, because obviously he is totally disgusted with the women's behavior. And don't worry, men, if you fail as being a man, then Yahweh will be the one to preserve the daughter of Zion and show men how it's done. And that's basically what he's doing, because there was no men keeping the women in the place they should have been kept. Again, that's why it's so important, woman, to be submitted to an authority figure. Verse 18, in that day, when this happens, when this comes about, Yahweh will take away the bravery of their tinkling ornaments and about their feet and their calves and their round tires. Remember, he said he's going to discover their secret parts, so he has to slowly strip them of everything to get to this nakedness and to show their barrenness in front of all the shame. So he's going to remove all this stuff that they trusted and felt heady and haughty and prideful and lofty in. He's going to remove their tinkling ornaments about their feet and their calves and their round tires like the moon, their chains, their bracelets, their mufflers, the bonnets, the ornaments of their legs and the headbands, the tablets and the earrings, the rings and the nose jewels, the changeable suits of apparel, the mantles and the wimples and the crisping pins. the glasses and the fine linen, the hoods and the veils. Again, you figure these women, they had all these things, and some of these women were probably women of status that actually have all these luxuries, all these nice things that they were out there flaunting themselves in. Who knows, but they had to get it from someplace. Who knows? All right, verse 24, and it shall come to pass that instead of a sweet smell, there shall be stink. Remember, Yah said he's going to bring them to an open shame. He's going to discover their secret parts. And if you look that up, that means pudenda, which is a woman's private area, okay? instead of a sweet smell, there shall be stink, and instead of a girdle, a rent, and instead of a well-set hair, baldness, and instead of a stomacher, a girding of sackcloth, and burning instead of beauty. Now, the word burning here, it just basically means disfigured, as in disfigured or taken to a place where all the things that these women trusted in to make them beautiful will have been removed, and all that remains will be the raw deal exposed and laid bare for all to see. So he's going to disfigure what they're walking in now and totally leave them as plain and as naked and as raw in their state as they possibly can get. That's what Yah was going to do. That men shall fall by the sword and the mighty men in war. Okay, as we started out in Isaiah in the first few verses and talking about the mighty men and all these lists of men that are going to be removed. And some of these men are going to fall by the sword, and their mighty men fighting against the forces of the invading army are going to get slain. And her gate shall lament and mourn, and she being desolate shall sit upon the ground. Okay, Isaiah chapter 4. Of course, it's verses 1 through 4. And we're going to have a few other. We're going to do something in Deuteronomy quickly and in Psalms, just to bring out a point. Okay, and in that day, seven women shall take hold of one man, saying, we will eat our own bread and wear our own apparel. Only let us be called by thy name to take away our reproach. Okay, so we have a situation, you have to look at it like this. There just wasn't seven women. There was all kind of women. You know, could have been thousands of women, right? And it's going to be that's going to be the math there, the ratio of seven women to one man. So depending on how many men are left in Judah at that time and are men that can be entrusted upon, I don't know where they're going to find them, but this is in the restoration of things when Yah starts to deliver his people. And then we're going to see these women scrambling and get back under cover, a covering, because the simply fact that they're being judged harshly and they're in a deep state of reproach as Yah has exposed them for their behavior. And they know they're out of place. So we will eat our own bread and wear our own apparel. Only let us be called by the name to take away our reproach. Again, we have a situation that presented itself, and these women are seeking to get under a covering. And it's by their hand, not by the man's incentive or the man's seeking, but it's by the women's hand again. Again, situational polygyny, and we're going to find out it's just more than that. Okay, these women obviously had great incentives to propel them to seek to be covered, to take away the reproach of the shameless way in which they conducted themselves as shown by Isaiah 3. You know, basically, you know, running for cover from the storm, and that, of course, being Yah's judgment, and looking for shelters, humans do, you know, that's what we do when there's things threatening in our lives and situations, right? We just run and duck for cover, right? Get up underneath something that we feel protected. This is, I think, going to be that kind of psychological thing going on with these women in this time when this happens. And it is often referenced that the reproach of these seven women is that they have not yet had child to take away the reproach, and that is completely understandable, as we read of this being the case many times, because you go back and study it, and you'll find out that the shame that a woman feels, the reproach, is because she hadn't been able to bear children for her husband. But in this particular case, it goes beyond that. It's simply because these women don't have a male figure over them. It may not be a husband. It could be a leader. It could be authority figure. And the reason that I can better say that is because if you were to say that every one of these women would have to have a child to take away their reproach, that means every seven women to one man ratio, every one of these women would have to be women that have never had children. Does that make sense? That means by default, by saying that the reproach is not having children, is that every one of these women would have to come into looking to be covered as the state of a virgin or whatever the case may be. But if you look at Isaiah 3, that's, you know, basically an impossibility, because even these were women of, we can pretty much agree, were all walks of life. They were, you know, they might have been single women, they might have been wives, they might have been sisters to, who knows, you know, brothers that went off to war. And you can't tell me there wasn't children mixed in, because it says children will be their oppressors. So they were mixed. So these women that were seeking to be underneath, take away their shame, be called by a man's name, were women that did have children, that women that may not have had children. So we can see the whole gamut working here, and that's why it's important to get the whole context of the whole story. But again, if this was, the reproach was bearing seed, then again, automatically by default, that would mean that every woman coming into this would have to have been a woman that has never produced a child. Okay, and I think that's as clear as we can make that. And again, what I believe is really being said is that those seven women, Isaiah 4:1, or that ratio, are the number available for men for the overall group of women, just like we talked about, the ones coming in Isaiah 3, because remember, there were so many women left, but the males had been all taken away, as Yahweh had said they would be. And this example just goes like, we'll use straightway here. You know, we have our single sisters, and we have, you know, Sister Vicky, we have Sister Barb here, faithful sisters, hardworking sisters. We have the young daughters that are here that aren't underneath a husband's covering, but they are covered, all of them. They're under the name of Pastor Charles Dahl when they're here at this community. That's who they're covered by. That's the one that's protecting them, giving advice, and making sure they get all the things necessary to live a fruitful and successful life, at least as daughters of Zion. So I believe that Isaiah 4:1 is actually saying that's what it's about. Again, we'll supply our own needs, our own food, our own clothing, whatever the case may be. Just let us be identified under your leadership and under your authority. And, of course, are some of them actually going to enter into polygynous situations? Absolutely. And why not? If that's the way it works out, that's the way it works out. And they still, regardless, they shall still be called by the name of that man. And I hope I'm making sense. Okay, so verse 2, in that day shall the branch of Yahweh be beautiful and glorious, and the fruit of the earth shall be excellent and comely for them that are escaped of Israel. Now, this verse here is relating for us the manner in which the things of the earth shall be, as in the things which the earth produces for the people to be fruitful and abundant, and not so much as, you know, bearing children, because you have to remember that Yah broke the stay and staff of bread. He created a famine. Well, now, because things are back in order again, men are back in their role, women are back in their role, and they're actually seeking to get under that covering because of the situation that they placed themselves in. And again, the situational polygyny and being situationally getting back underneath the covering, the earth is going to, again, because everything's back in order, going to start to give her abundance again back to feed the people. And I'll show you a couple places that this really isn't talking about fruit as in from the womb, because this is saying from the fruit of the earth shall be excellent and comely for them that escaped of Israel. And quickly, a couple examples of the fruit of the earth and the fruit of the womb as used in the word. Deuteronomy 26, verses 1 and 2. And it shall be, when thou art come to the land which Yahweh the Elohim giveth thee for an inheritance and possesseth it, and dwellest therein, that thou shalt take first of all the fruit of the earth. Okay, we're talking the same exact language here, and you look up, these words are all the same in Hebrew, which thou shalt bring of the land that Yahweh the Elohim giveth thee, and shall put it in a basket, clearly talking about the produce and the agriculture and the crops that the earth produces, and shall go unto the place Yahweh the Elohim shall choose to place his name. But if we read in Psalm 127, verse 3, it says, lo, children are heritage of Yahweh, and the fruit of the womb, making a distinction between the earth and the womb, is his reward. And verse 13, Deuteronomy 7, 13, he will love thee and bless thee and multiply. He will also bless the fruit of thy womb and the fruit of the land. So we see both blessings coming on not only in the womb, but also on the land, and the corn and the wine and thine own, and the increase of thy kind, and the flocks of thy sheep, and the land which she sware unto the fathers to give thee. And if you look behind the word land, that means soil or earth. So we have a distinction between here. So Isaiah 4:2, again, it's not talking about children. It's talking about the replenishing of the earth as a food supply by the hand of Yah to, again, feed the people because they're back in an ordered state for them that escaped of Israel. In verse 3, and it shall come to pass that he that is left in Zion and he that remaineth in Jerusalem shall be called holy, and everyone that is written among the living in Jerusalem. When Yahweh shall have washed away the filth of the daughters of Zion, again, that's of the state that he saw them in because of their actions, and shall have purged the blood of Jerusalem in the midst thereof by the spirit of burning and the spirit of spirit of judgment and the spirit of burning, which means ruin. So anyway, that's the conclusion with this blog talk tonight. I hope that I was able to impart something into our minds about, you know, the situations that have arisen. And again, Yah, you know, he interferes in men's lives and puts them in that situation. And we see in some of these occasions to enter into polygynous situation. And I think by reading, we can see that the men's minds weren't really there. They were going to be satisfied with a life with just one wife and one woman. And then Yahweh shows up and says, I got other plans. And he rearranges the house. And that's how we made these promises get fulfilled. So again, it was just, I think, a huge dynamic to look at and to understand about the minds of the patriarch and the minds of the women as well, and how they're the one that created oftentimes a situation for a man to take another wife and then, you know, and have another wife taken into the home, you know, because they're the ones that started this. But anyway, bless y'all. I hope y'all have a blessed week. Again, get your hearts and minds prepared for the coming feast. Trumpets is just around the corner. And, of course, you know, atonement and the tabernacle through the 8 days. And, you know, hey, it's that time of the year again when Yah tells his people to keep his feast because they are the feast of the Most High. But y'all have a blessed week. And again, always in your prayers, remember to lift up the men of Yah, especially the shepherds that Yah has given you to teach you with knowledge and understanding of his word, his way, and his will, because we definitely need that in this day and hour. And, you know, pray for one another. Absolutely pray for one another that, you know, we may all be healed and we all would walk in towards perfection and imperfection. But anyway, bless y'all, Israel. You have a great rest of your week. And I don't think I'll be talking to y'all until, it'll be well after Tabernacles, probably before November. But hey, glory to the King. Hallelujah, bless y'all. Hey, the King is coming.